Wolfgang Pauli was one of the most brilliant physicists of his time, but he was also savage in his criticism. Happy to use his considerable wit to tear apart ideas or theories he thought lacking, he took to signing off his letters with the title D. Geisel Gottes, German for the Scourge of God. But perhaps most famously, he once solemnly responded to a young physicist's earnest paper with a simple but brutal epithet, that the offending work was not even wrong. Although not all ideas have a Pauli to puncture them, most scientific theories do end up dead and forgotten. Most scientific theories fail. They may have had their day, they may have been widely believed, the focus of papers, seminars, and conferences, only to end up a footnote in the history books. Once upon a time, it was thought that something called phlogiston existed. Residing inside objects, it was released when they were burned. During the 18th century, the theory of phlogiston was one of the foremost explanations for heat and combustion. Professors taught it, students learnt it, and the chemists of the day attempted to interpret their results with it. But the idea, very simply, was wrong. The phlogiston account of heat was a fantasy. The truth, as we now know, lay in chemistry and the combination of different elements in various chemical reactions. Somewhere, at some point in history, the last believer in the phlogiston theory of heat died. In the mid-20th century, there were two competing ideas for understanding the origin of matter in the universe. One was the Big Bang theory, the idea that the cosmos was once extremely small, dense and hot, and then expanded into the vast cosmic structures we observe today. But there was also another competing theory, the so-called steady-state theory, in which matter was constantly being created to sustain the universe so that it remained, on large scales, eternally the same. At one time, the steady-state theory was one of the most discussed ideas in astrophysics and cosmology. Even Einstein had an interest in it. But over the years, evidence piled up in favor of the Big Bang, and with the discovery of hugely powerful quasars at cosmological distances, which dated from the younger universe and have no counterparts today, gradually the lights went out for steady state. The last conference was held, the last talks were given, and the last adherents of the idea retired, leaving only filing cabinets packed with old, yellowing notes. And so, we arrive to the present day, and the ongoing quest for a fundamental theory that explains everything within our universe. The quest to unite the two pillars of general relativity and quantum mechanics. Our current leading frameworks for quantum gravity are known as string theory and M theory. Ideas which claim extra dimensions and tiny vibrating strings exist deep within everything at the as-yet unobserved heart of nature, or even vast multidimensional brains stretched across an imperceivable bulk. Many, many physicists and mathematicians are working on these cutting-edge ideas. Regular conferences are being held packed with both young and old, all chasing the holy grail of physics, a unified theory that explains it all. But will these theories last? Do they really represent viable solutions to the fundamental questions of the universe, or a tragically misled community lost in elegant mathematics with no hope of finding connections to the real world, let alone a shred of testable evidence? Will, one day, string and M theory too be found as dusty footnotes in fading tomes? Are they, as Pauli once mused, not even wrong? What is meant by fundamental? Push distances inwards. Start with us, bipedal members of Homo sapiens sapiens, normally standing a bit over 1.5 meters. focus our view narrower and narrower, first to the scale of insects, little creepy-crawly objects 1 centimeter across, a factor of 100. Next, head down to the size of cells, the powerhouses of human metabolism. That brings us down by another factor of 10,000, reaching micrometers. We go again. Another scaling down by a factor of 1,000 brings us first to molecules, and then to atoms and the quantum mechanical bonds of electrons in orbitals that hold atoms together to form the building blocks of life. We are now at distances slightly less than 1/1,000,000th of a meter, where quantum mechanics rules. If we were to look around in a little cube 1/1,000,000th of a meter across, then the number of such cubes that would fit inside our body is greater than the number of stars in the observable universe. And yet this is only the start of our inwards journey. At the center of atoms lies the nucleus, the radius of the nucleus 100,000 times smaller than the size of the atom itself. The nuclear ball consists of protons and neutrons, little clumps of quarks both held together by the strong nuclear force and also attracted to each other by the strong nuclear force. We are now at distances of 1 femtometer, 1 million-billionth of a meter, and entering the realm of particle physics. Particle colliders are our world's most powerful microscopes. Using these, and in particular the Large Hadron Collider, we are able to probe inwards by an extra factor of 1,000 to picometers. But no more. The realm beyond this is the realm of theory, where we would continue to go inner, deeper and further until we reach the scales on which our ordinary classical notions of space and time break down, and must be replaced by some quantum mechanical replacement for the classical theory of space-time described by Einstein's theory of relativity. Calculations suggest that this would occur at a distance of 1 million-billionth of a picometer, where quantum gravity will take over. And it is at this distance scale we perhaps reach the scale of strings. Relativistic quantum mechanical strings that some physicists say may be the most fundamental building blocks of the universe, what everything is truly made of. And yet, surprisingly, this idea, string theory, did not start off as a potential fundamental theory of nature. To climb back up the ladder, at distance scales of around a femtometer, only 1 million-billionth of a meter, we are in the realm of the strong force. The strong force, which, at one point, many people believed was actually a string force. String theory started its life in the summer of 1968 as a possible theory of the strong nuclear force, a candidate to explain the forces and interactions that hold protons and neutrons together. The first paper on string theory arrived in Berkeley in the summer of 1968. Everyone had stopped what they were doing and were asking if this idea could be extended. However, it did not turn out to be a success. In this string theory account of the strong force, the internal structure of protons and neutrons involved strings, not particles. This made a clear prediction. When launched towards each other at high energies, these particles would slop off each other like balls of jelly and not bounce like hard billiard balls. And so, in the early 1970s, these experiments were carried out, and careful measurements revealed that the number of these hard scattering events was far, far in excess of what was predicted by the string theory of the strong nuclear force. As a theory of the strong nuclear force, string theory died in 1973, to be replaced by the correct theory of quantum chromodynamics. But in theoretical physics, sometimes death is only the prelude to resurrection. Some felt that there was something too neat about the calculations in string theory, beautiful features that had no obvious reason to be present, and yet were. And so, throughout the 1970s, some physicists, notably John Schwartz of Caltech and Michael Green of Queen Mary in London, continued to develop string theory, not as a quantum theory of the strong nuclear force, but as a potential quantum theory of gravity itself. Many times, it seemed that the theory was on the verge of failing, of being ruled out as simply inconsistent with the laws of quantum mechanics. It only seemed to work where there were precisely 9 dimensions of space, neither more nor less. But then, always there was a way through that made the theory appear ever more unique. During the 1980s, string theory became established as the leading candidate for a quantum theory that would include gravity. A theory where you could put both gravity and forces like electromagnetism together in harmony for the first time. Perhaps some dared to dream in proud and foolish dreams. All aspects of particle physics would be uniquely singled out. Everything could be predicted with strings. However, by the late 1980s, one aspect of string theory appeared odd. It had been touted as the theory, at least in universes with 10 flat space-time dimensions, the singular answer to all of the problems of particle physics. The only problem was that there was not just one string theory, which existed in 10 dimensions. There were 5 of them. The type 2A string theory, the type 2B theory, 2 type 1 theories, and finally, something called the heterotic string theory. The theories all had slight differences. Both the type 2 theories and also the heterotic theory were what is called closed string theories. All the strings involved were closed loops reaching back on themselves, like elastic bands. They had no ends. Between themselves, the internal dynamics of these 3 theories also differed slightly. The strings in each case behaved in different ways. The type 1 theories also included closed strings, but in addition, open strings. These were not closed, but instead had endpoints vibrating at the speed of light like a perpetually cracking whip. The open and closed strings differed in their interactions. While the closed strings behaved more like gravity, the open strings behaved like generalization of the electromagnetic, weak, and strong forces. And so, 5. 5 is not a large number, however, it posed a puzzle. 5 is not 1. To any ambitious, possibly arrogant, physicist hoping that string theory might be the unique theory, even 2 would have been 1 too large. Given the existence of 5 consistent theories, what singled out one of these 5 theories, as opposed to any of the others, as the chosen one? The presence of 5 different theories did not imply that each theory only had one solution. In the same way that our ordinary theory of gravity contains as a solution both a single lonely rock flying through space and the full complexities of our solar system with satellites orbiting moons, orbiting planets, orbiting the sun, so each of these 5 string theories admitted many, many different possible solutions for their equations. There may have only been 5 possible sets of fundamental equations, but the number of solutions was effectively unbounded. But still, in terms of the fundamental equations, there appeared to be 5 choices. And 5 is not the same as 1. In an ancient Indian parable, an elephant wanders into a town where a group of blind men are sitting. The blind men can hear the beast and decide that they need to touch it to get a sense of what it is. One places his hand on the trunk, reaches around and feels along it. "I know," he announces. "The being is a type of snake." Another man touches one of the elephant's legs and feels how large and strong they are. "No," he says, "this is a kind of walking tree trunk." A third man finds his hand on the tusk, hard, long, and sharp. "You are both wrong," he says. "This is a moving war machine." Each could feel one part of the animal, but none of them could see the coherent mega-animal that is the elephant. Viewed from today, the physicists of the 1980s studying 5 string theories are like the blind townsfolk touching the elephant. And that is because today we think of each of these 5 theories as different limits, different boundaries of a single underlying object, one both deeper and more mysterious, not an elephant, but M theory. And whether M stands for mystery, magic, or something else has been left open to interpretation. Of course, the idea that five similar but different string theories were actually aspects of one single whole would have appeared bizarre and surprising. That is, until Edward Witten spoke at the 1995 Strings Conference. Edward Witten is the physicist who almost never was. Widely regarded as the premier mathematical physicist of his generation, his undergraduate degree was in history. After briefly assisting on the 1968 McGovern presidential campaign, he decided that his principal interest lay in the sciences. Still unsure that he would be able to catch up, he initially applied to do graduate studies in economics. Fortunately, Princeton saw through his background to detect the innate talent and took him on as a graduate student in theoretical physics. Theoretical physics and pure mathematics are two subjects divided by a common language. Although both use similar notation, their ways of thinking and standards of rigor are very different. To a mathematician, physicists are frustratingly sloppy, with a fundamental inability to give precise definitions. To physicists, mathematicians are so obsessed with rigor and proving results that are obvious, they can never address problems that actually matter. Witten's great gift was that he was fluent in both languages, and rose to prominence at a time when the interface between physics and mathematics had been long neglected. He reignited the relationship, using quantum field theory and string theory to draw many deep connections between the two subjects, resulting in him becoming the first physicist to win the Fields Medal, the premier prize in mathematics. And so, by 1995, a long list of discoveries had turned Witten into the person everybody wanted to hear. As participants finished their welcome coffee and settled down for the 9 a.m. talk on the 14th of March at the 1995 Strings Conference, some of them had an inkling that they were about to witness something special. But as Witten got up and began talking, the audience soon realized that this was something truly monumental. For he was describing a wholly new map of string theory. There were not, Witten claimed, actually five fundamental theories, but really only one, and the five string theories and one extra non-string theory called supergravity should be viewed as being on the boundary of one even more fundamental, M theory. This one theory was continuously connected through a mysterious interior, in the same way that flourishing coastal cities like Perth, Darwin, Adelaide, and Sydney are all part of the single continent of Australia, filled with a large interior desert. The path through the interior may be difficult and complicated, but it does exist and joins these boundary cities together. Indeed, the M in M theory didn't stand for anything in particular, but had been chosen as a placeholder of sorts. The word beginning with M to be finally decided in the future, when more about the theory revealed itself. And what was more, said Witten, M theory was 11-dimensional, not 10, and the fundamental objects of this 11-dimensional theory were no longer strings, but a mysterious object taken from supergravity, the sixth theory. The fundamental objects of M theory were brains. These were extended objects stretching through more than one spatial dimension. When some of these spatial dimensions became very small, the brains could wrap around them and look like strings. And in these situations, the 11-dimensional theory could, in practice, be described as a string theory. So, for 10 years, string theorists had been working obsessively on a theory of strings, on string theory as the proposed fundamental picture of nature. And now, the most dominant intellectual figure in the subject was saying that it was not strings, but rather higher-dimensional objects called brains, which really mattered. But what were these mysterious brains? And how can we visualize them? Start with a string, a one-dimensional object under tension, a violin string, a wire, a long thread. At heart, the strings of string theory are just one-dimensional extended objects, and all the physics from string theory flows from studying the relativistic quantum mechanical theories of one-dimensional extended objects, moving and oscillating their quantum mechanical relativistic way through space. A brain is basically a version of this with more dimensions. The name comes from membrane, the two-dimensional version, a taut surface. Think the skin of a drum, the boundary of a cell, or the surface of a soap bubble. A two-brain is an object extended through two spatial dimensions, a three-brain extended through three spatial dimensions, and so on. A one-brain is simply a string. While it is relatively easy for us to visualize stretched objects with one spatial dimension, or two spatial dimensions, mathematics happily extends this idea to even more spatial dimensions. For example, the equations can define, even if we cannot visualize, an object with four spatial dimensions extended within a space of nine spatial dimensions. And so, the world of M-theory, Witten told his audience, was one of 11 dimensions, and with brains, not strings, as the fundamental objects. Different lower energy limits of this 11-dimensional world, in which one of the dimensions became small, produced the five 10-dimensional string theories the audience were already familiar with, the string theories that could be the quantum gravity theories of our world. In these lower energy situations, like our universe, the brains of M-theory, in particular something called the M2 brain, turn into the strings of 10-dimensional string theories. But what does this all mean? How can a brain turn into a string as one dimension becomes small? What, indeed, does it even mean for a dimension to become small? There is no way to make this perfectly intuitive, but we can meet our intuition part of the way. How might extra dimensions be real, but yet unobservable? One way to have a sense of this is to imagine an insect walking on a plant vine, a vine both long and thin. An ant or any other insect can walk along the vine either forwards or backwards. The surface of the vine certainly has two dimensions. Zooming in with a powerful microscope, we would see the surface made up of many cells, stretching off in all directions. But the insect, small though it is still too large to treat the vine as having anything more than one linear dimension. In truth, the surface of the vine has two dimensions, but to a big enough insect, there is effectively only a single dimension. As for the ant, so too, perhaps, for us. If these extra dimensions are small enough, we and all our technology are simply too big and too clunky to resolve them, like building Lego with boxing gloves. Without tools that probe such incredibly small distances, any structure on these distances is simply inaccessible. This is believed to be the case for the extra dimensions of string theory, the extra six spatial dimensions wrapped up very, very small. But M-theory takes this counterintuitive concept a step further. Imagine a two-dimensional M-brain, an incredibly high-tension shrink-wrapping surface wrapped around a long, thin wire. Objects under tension want to shrink and fold up. Think of the spandex material of a morph suit. This is a two-dimensional stretched object which is under tension and has a natural tendency to shrink its surface area, so that it tightly wraps the object which defines the boundaries, in this case, the human inside it. And so the extreme tension of the brain shrinks it down and wraps itself around the wire, effectively turning it into a one-dimensional object. And much of the connection of M-theory to string theory relies on this idea, brains wrapping around small dimensions, thus becoming lower dimensional objects. Objects which would, in string theory, ultimately make up, at a fundamental level, the world we experience. Where one of the 11 dimensions of M-theory becomes very small, much smaller than any of the other dimensions, the one-dimensional strings of string theory would emerge from the truly fundamental two-dimensional brains of M-theory, in part by wrapping around the small extra 11th dimension, thus becoming one-dimensional. Indeed, all five string theories emerged as various limits of 11-dimensional M-theory with one small dimension. Our universe would hypothetically exist on one of the low-energy boundaries of this mysterious M-theory, a world of strings born from wrapping higher-dimensional brains around minuscule, extra dimensions. And so, On that California morning in 1995, a new view of string theory appeared out of the mist, one in which even the strings themselves were not fundamental objects, arising, as they did, from another even more fundamental object. Mathematically, this was remarkable. But what did it mean for reality? Could the brains of M-theory ever really make predictions about our world, of a hot Big Bang, an expanding universe full of majestic galaxies? When you look closely at the surface of a pond, you can sometimes see insects perched there, water boatmen or backswimmers. They skit along the surface, apparently oblivious to the depths below or the great heights above. For such insects, it appears that the water surface is their home, and they are confined to it, separate to the great bulk above. And perhaps, some scientists wonder, the same is true of us. As for the insects on the surface of the pond in three-dimensional space, so for us, living on a brain embedded within higher dimensional space. For as well as the fundamental two-dimensional M2 brains, M-theory also predicts five-dimensional M5 brains. When wrapped around both the small extra 11th dimension of M-theory and one of the small dimensions of string theory, some physicists have speculated that these five-dimensional brains could become three-dimensional and large enough to fill a universe. And so perhaps, they say, we live on such a brain, embedded within a higher dimensional space, and the electromagnetic weak and strong forces that make up the standard model of particle physics are fluctuations which spread out along the brain, confined to its surface. As ripples are confined to the surface of a pond, so waves on a brain would be confined to the surface of this three-dimensional brain. Though were this to be true, the one exception would be gravity. Gravity, it seems, is the most universal of forces, and it follows from the equations that gravity is not, and can never be, confined to the surface of a brain. Its force lines spread out not just within, but also away from the brain. It is this that provides one possible explanation for why the gravitational force is so much weaker than all the other forces. With just your little finger and its electromagnetic nerve impulses, you can pick up a pen against the gravitational pull of the entire Earth, all 6 billion trillion tons of it acting together to pull the pen downwards. Why? What makes gravity so much weaker than the other forces? Perhaps this is because our universe resides on a brain, inside a 10-dimensional space-time, and while the strong, weak, and electromagnetic force lines remain within the brain, the gravitational force lines spread out in additional dimensions, thus reducing their potency. Our cosmology, only a fraction of the truth of heaven and earth. And that is not the only road physicists and philosophers have gone down when exploring the brain world. Brains and the possibility of two colliding brains also appear in cosmological scenarios for the early universe. In the idea of brain inflation, the enormous tensions and energies associated with brains would have been responsible for driving a period of enormously rapid accelerated expansion in the early universe. In this scenario, the motion of a brain through an extra-dimensional bulk would have been responsible for generating the early acceleration of the universe we believe occurred. In another scenario, called the ekpyrotic scenario, in the far past, another brain would have travelled towards our brain, colliding through and past it. The legacy of this collision would be a series of small deformations on the surface of our brain, which would subsequently grow under gravity to the cosmic superstructures, galaxies and clusters of galaxies, which we observe today. And so, the possible ramifications of living on a brain are intriguing. But why imagine exotic and speculative higher dimensional cosmologies unless we have any reason to think that they could possibly be correct? That these notions of brains and M-theory actually make any sense in the first place? There is one ordeal all theoretical physicists face at some point. A thick envelope arrives containing a neatly printed book. The accompanying letter explains. Since retirement, I have been developing a new theory of nature, and I think I have found some errors Einstein made. Perhaps you would be so kind to take a look. The manuscript will be, in Pauli's phrase, not even wrong. Instead, the concepts will be undefined, the sentences will not follow from one another as ill-defined equation follows ill-defined equation. To an expert in theoretical physics, the manuscript is clearly nonsense, even if to an outsider, one complicated equation looks very much like another complicated equation. And so this question lingers on behind every new development. Is something similar true of M-theory? Is it not even wrong? There are two notions of correctness in play here. The first is the question of whether M-theory is a true theory of our world. If we look at the universe on the deepest possible scales, if we look to smaller and smaller distances, higher and higher energies, will M-theory be the ultimate theory of our existence? Are string theory, M-theory, and brains included as part of the same great painting that features Newton's laws of gravity, Maxwell's laws of electromagnetism, the special and general theories of relativity, and the standard model of particle physics? Are they true? Theoretical physics is hard at the best of times, even when operating together with experimental evidence. And this is a problem, for the ideas of string theory and brains and other theories of quantum gravity tread an especially lonely path, a path beyond the direct reach of experiment. For there is absolutely zero direct experimental evidence for M or string theory. Direct experimental evidence would require us, as a species, either to devise or build large experiments and large colliders which can determine the truth about this universe. And for theories of quantum gravity, this is a very hard task. To put this challenge in perspective, the Large Hadron Collider reaches energies that are smaller than those required to test the scales of quantum gravity by a factor of 100,000 billion. To build an equivalent collider that could reach energies at the quantum gravity scale, using the same technology, a similar set of magnets running the entire way round the Earth's equator would be hopelessly inadequate. One would instead need a similar circular collider around the Sun, somewhere between Mercury and Venus, which is not going to happen anytime soon. But there is a second notion of correctness, still hard to achieve, but not quite as hard as a solar system spanning collider. This is the notion of mathematical correctness, of internal consistency. How do we test that our equations actually make sense? To a non-scientist trying to follow debates about the frontiers of theoretical physics, these discussions can sometimes sound like a Pokemon battle, with scientists throwing ideas at each other. Perturbative finiteness, dualities, or background independence. Who is right? Either, both, or no one? It is very hard to tell. In principle, one may think this question is easily answered by reading someone's papers. Just go and look and see if what they say makes sense. But in practice, this is not so straightforward. Understanding someone else's new ideas takes time. How can we tell apart a wrong idea from one we simply have not grasped yet? Or, alternatively, how can we tell for sure that an idea or theory is internally consistent? And so above all, in the absence of any experimental data, or even the possibility of it, how can we ever prove whether brains, hidden dimensions, and M-theory are right or wrong? Does M-theory ultimately represent a fresh example of Pauli's brutal put-down, an untestable, not even right, not even wrong rabbit hole of elegant equations? Or is there another way? A short distance from the never-sleeping city of New York lies the quiet college town of Princeton. And at the edge of this famous campus lies the Institute for Advanced Study, secluded amongst the woods. The professors of the Institute for Advanced Study do not need to teach undergraduates or turn up to practical classes to show clumsy students how to use an oscilloscope. Instead, they are paid to think deep thoughts. Robert Oppenheimer led the Institute at one time. Freeman Dyson was another faculty member. But one of the very first hires was the most famous, Albert Einstein. Although his spell there in the latter part of his career was not his most productive era, as he struggled in vain to find a unified theory of all physics. Today, one of the most preeminent thinkers there is the Argentinian physicist Juan Maldacena. Quiet and softly spoken, there are many other physicists who are brasher or louder. Few are deeper. And so it was in 1997 that Maldacena, buried in profound thought on the physics of brains, introduced a striking new idea. Whereas M-theory seems to have been named with an eye for the attention it may bring, this idea had a far more humble moniker. The ADS-CFT correspondence. This correspondence is probably the most important theoretical idea to have emerged from string theory in the last 30 years, for it leads to a profound re-evaluation of what gravity means, and also what a dimension of space means. Maldacena's remarkable insight had originated from thinking about what physics would look like to a hypothetical observer moving extremely close to a brain. There were, he argued, two possible ways of thinking about this. In the first, he imagined life on the brain, looking at all the physics in terms of fluctuations of the surface of the brain. Physics, if you like, perceived by the water boatman on the surface of the pond, and how these fluctuations interacted with themselves and each other. In the second, he imagined the brain as a gravitational object within a larger space-time, with the description now all governed by the higher dimensional theory of gravity. Physics viewed by a higher dimensional external observer peering down at the surface of the pond. Maldacena's key insight was that while the actual physics had to be ultimately the same, these two different observers would use very different equations to develop these same physics. The observers living on the brain would describe these physics using a non-gravitational theory, a theory analogous to those used to describe the Standard Model. The second observer, the person peering close to the surface of the pond, is the external one in the bulk. This observer sees the brain as a gravitational object within space-time, and describes all of the physics near it using a gravitational theory, a theory which uses all of the spatial dimensions of the brain itself, but with one extra spatial dimension corresponding to the vertical direction perpendicular to the surface of the brain. Maldacena realized that as these two theories describe the same physics, they must always give identical answers. Even though the descriptions of the two different observers appeared very different, there was only one physical system, and so the results they gave must be the same. Whatever the process, for any physical quantity one could compute in this system, there would be two different ways to obtain the answer. The first, using the theory of the first observer, similar to those used to describe the strong force within the Standard Model, while the second was a purely gravitational theory, involving an extra dimension of space. Perhaps Maldacena dared to dream it was because these apparently different descriptions were actually the same theory. In the terminology of physics, the two accounts were dual to one another. Any calculation you could do in one, you could also do in the other. Famously, the Rosetta Stone allowed Egyptian hieroglyphics to be deciphered through the knowledge that the information on the stone was the same in all three of the languages used. A duality is like a scientific version of the Rosetta Stone, where exactly the same information is present, except presented in different languages. Here is one quantity computed with this theory, a product of a heroic calculation to levels of accuracy that go beyond any of those achieved within the Standard Model of particle physics. If you were asked to write down a random fraction, you would not be writing down these. There is no way you could write down this expression by chance. This expression arose as a result of the calculation in physics as perceived by the observer, living on the brain, looking at the brain as a surface under tension which fluctuates, although in this case the surface is a four-dimensional hypersurface. According to Maldacena's duality, this calculation should be precisely and totally equivalent to a calculation done in a five-dimensional gravitational theory. And this calculation has also been done, exactly the same. All the complicated structure of the first calculation, worked out in the four-dimensional theory for those living on the brain, is reproduced by the second calculation, done in a five-dimensional gravity, which views the brain as a gravitational object inside a higher-dimensional space-time. But what did this all mean? To understand this, we must first understand something about one general property of quantum theories. Some theories are more quantum than others. For some descriptions of physics, classical physics works extremely well. To describe how gravity affects a ball thrown in the air, we do not need to use quantum mechanics. Although quantum effects are there, they are so utterly tiny that we can entirely neglect them. Near a black hole singularity, quantum effects may matter in gravity, but for most purposes, they are minuscule. But for other theories, the quantum nature of the system is crucial to everything. For physicists trying to understand the details of the strong force inside the standard model of particle physics, the quantum effects are always large. And this was the surprise. For a pivotal feature of Maldacena's duality was the equivalence, the sameness, between a gravitational theory in five dimensions and a non-gravitational theory in four dimensions. It was a shocking claim that initially appeared to physicists as complete nonsense. A gravity theory in five dimensions being the same as a non-gravitational theory in four dimensions, it made no sense. But this was the key. The fact that on first appearance the claim was bizarre and obviously wrong is what made its truth so profound. Ever since it was first proposed, the evidence for Maldacena's bold conjecture about the physics of brains, the ADS-CFT correspondence, has piled up. And this evidence has shown again and again that brains in string theory are mathematically and theoretically consistent, even if we still don't know whether they relate to the real world. Whatever our initial skepticism, whatever our initial surprise, it seems that at least this duality is, on a mathematical level, true. Radically different theories can, in fact, carry the same information in different languages. There was no way that this could have been chance. Clearly, manifestly, there was a deeper structure, a deeper, consistent structure that explained these mathematical connections. Very different starting points, very different calculations, but ultimately, the same answer. And most importantly, for our understanding of the world, this could only happen if the brains of string theory were real, consistent objects. Of course, whether M-theory is, ultimately, the consistent theory of our world, we do not know. Yet. But we do know enough to say that it is a consistent theory of something. Deep ideas lurk behind the symbols. Space, the final frontier. Not so in the world of physics. But will the drive to penetrate the ever more fundamental parts of physics, through atoms, through nuclei, through subatomic particles and the standard model, down to the mysterious realm of quantum gravity, will this lead us to the fabled final frontier? Or are the explanations endless? Do they continue to cascade onwards, further and deeper, getting smaller and more fundamental forever and ever? Perhaps not. Perhaps the zooming stops with tiny quantum mechanical strings and brains at the heart of everything. We do not, as yet, know. What we can say now, though, is that the ideas of brains, of dualities, of a map of theories linked together into an overall M theory, are mathematically consistent. And just perhaps, this foreshadows physical correctness as well. You've been watching the entire history of the universe. Don't forget to like and subscribe and leave a comment to tell us what you think. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.